What is up, sports fans? It's back. The NFL, week one. Here we are. Sports odds and ends. The reason we even started this show. I'm King Cass. I'm joined by my good friend and co-host, the one, the great JVZ. What's up?
I take offense to the idea that we started the show for the NFL, considering how much we shit on it here.
For
the catch
for
rule.
Guys, yeah. Guys, didn't you guys start the show because Draymond Green kicked somebody in the junk?
That ended up being the pretty much we started it for our mutual love of sports, but Draymond Green helped carry us through like our first 100 episodes.
I'm pretty sure our earliest mock-ups of the Sports Odds and Ends logo was Draymond Green kicking a silhouette of Draymond Green's kicking Steven Adams in the balls. But yeah, it's getting close to 150 episodes where we're getting there. I mean, we've seen a lot of cool stories develop over this time. It's been fun. I don't know why we got on this tangent. It sounds like we're wrapping things up and we're totally not.
We're just excited. We've been through a lot with all the COVID stuff and a lot of it is still going on. We're still seeing a lot of ramifications of that. We're going to try to figure out what's going to happen after this first week of football. Because there's some shit that I want to talk about when we get to football. But yeah, so let's just get back to the norm. Let's head into the roundup. Let's talk a little bit about tennis and what's going on there.
Yeah. First of all, I'm kind of surprised we had a U.S. Open, given the state of COVID in the U.S. But I think I guess I'm not surprised considering how everybody else is just powering through everything. I wouldn't really even call it powering through as much as stumbling through. I guess tennis is a socially distanced sport. It's not as worrying as football is.
You just got to watch out for the random ball coming at you every once in a while.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But at least just to wrap up the finals, Naomi Osaka won her third Grand Slam victory.
She's doing big things.
Yeah, after a 3-set comeback. This is her third Grand Slam and she's 22 years old. So, I guess not the youngest, to perform that well, but I think, she's on a pretty incredible career trajectory considering how good she's gotten so quickly in her career. So, I think we mentioned a couple weeks ago that she might be one of, if not the most marketable personality in tennis right now, so it's only going up from here, and currently she's using her platform to I think she's wearing a lot of basically every match day she came in wearing a different mask with a different name of a black person that was shot by the police. So I think trying to bring using her platform at a very young age to bring attention to a cause that she cares about. So, and she's not shy about it. She's, we'll definitely hear a lot more from her because she's going to be at the top of her sport for a very long time. The men's final is, later today. We're recording on Sunday. So, Dominic Thiem and Alexander Zverev are the two participants in the men's final. If you don't recognize, I mean, they're the 2 seed and the 5 seed, so they're pretty well-known names in tennis, but I think we're all kind of used to seeing Roger Federer or Rafael Nadal or Novak Djokovic in the final of these Grand Slam events. The reason why Novak Djokovic is not there is because he, in a fit of rage, hit a ball at a linesman.
No,
I forgot what the actual I will
make a sense of defense for this, right? He hit a ball in a fit of rage, but it wasn't directed at anyone.
Right. Yeah, we have to be careful yeah. about how we say this, because like everybody talking about this is like, well, he didn't do this on purpose,
right?
But which at is the same which, time, I'll post this video in the in the roundup. Somebody made this little comedy compilation of like with the Curb Your Enthusiasm theme overlaid on it. But basically, he's been warned in the past for his tendency to just smack balls in fits of rage towards, you know, just at nobody in particular. But you know, that's dangerous. So, and he was criticized for it, and he very flippantly said, well, I haven't hit anybody yet. And, but this is the first time he hit somebody and hit a ball person in the neck, and, to the point where she needed medical attention. And, you know, because of that, he was kicked out of the tournament. I think he had to sacrifice all of his whatever prize money he would have gotten for losing in that round. He was basically just kind of deleted from the tournament, and number one overall player in the world. This after he's had a rough couple of months, self-inflicted, really. But you know, between his tournament that he tried to organize that got a bunch of people infected with COVID, and this kind of misguided attempt at forming a union that excluded women players, and now this, it's been not a great couple months for Novak Djokovic.
No, it's a rough thing, right? And it's one of the things I've seen a lot of tennis players kind of do this. But he definitely is one that, like, kind of he sends the ball, and it's just one of those things where it's kind of a behavior thing, right? It's just like, it's just at a certain point, it's a tick of frustration that you have that you got to learn how to curve. You know what I mean? It's something he's probably been doing his whole life, so that's why he defends it. It's his way of letting out his frustration is you know, just sending the ball. But it's one of those things at this point, you got to find a better way to deal with it.
Yeah, and it looks especially dumb with how much he's tried to flippantly defend himself in the past for it, and now he's going to be a whole lot more careful about it. You know, you do live and learn, but hopefully somebody doesn't have to get hurt in order for you to do that. But I'm sure he feels like an idiot now. I'm sure his pocketbook is a little bit lighter than he expected. And his reputation took a bit of a hit because now everybody's dredging up these old videos of him being a dick to people that are confronting him about this. And so it's, yeah, he's, you know, I guess on to the next major, I guess, which would be Australia in a couple months, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully he can recover from this and set a better example for people in the future. Safety isn't just about COVID. It's about, you know, being mindful of your surroundings. Sports can be dangerous, not just for the people playing, but for the people that are standing on the sidelines, or the people that are, I mean, especially like the volunteers and the other people that are supposed to be helping with the tournament. Like, you volunteer for something like this with the expectation that you're going to be safe when you do it, and not with the expectation that you're going to get hit in the throat because somebody got mad.
Yeah, I don't know. It's dumb on his part. It's a silly thing that seems silly until something serious happens, and he should have been more mindful. All right, let's talk a little bit about esports, or mainly the LCS and some of the problems plaguing them that aren't necessarily COVID related, but are more California related. So a power outage that happened in LA. Now, I don't know if it was part of the rolling blackouts.
It was.
Okay. This has been
kind of personal to me, just because, I mean, not really me in particular, because I happen to be in a very I happen to be in one of those golden safe zones because I think we have a lot of hospitals nearby.
Yeah.
But yeah, due to the heat wave in California last week, which that combined with all the fires and all the COVID stuff and all the other disasters going on. And
yeah, I'm coming to California for a vacation.
It's been a mess. But yeah, due to the rolling blackouts, or due to the heat wave, we had rolling blackouts throughout the state because people were turning on their air conditioners and using up a lot of power, or too much power too quickly. And so because of that, we had rolling blackouts, but because of COVID, all these players are playing from home, or particularly FlyQuest and TSM, who are the two teams in the LCS final. I think TSM had gathered everybody into one of their facilities, but yeah. FlyQuest had chosen to play from home basically throughout the entire pandemic. I think, you know, to set a good example for everybody. And so they managed to make that work so far, despite, you know, internet connections and all that. This is the first time I think that that's actually caused a problem because in the middle of one of the games, I think what happened was there was like a normal pause for some sort of glitch. And then in the middle of that, the Wild Turtle, the AD carry for FlyQuest, had a power outage. And then they had to wait for an hour for him to drive to the FlyQuest facility and play from right. there. And then, so they could continue.
This is in Los Angeles, which is yeah. just notoriously has some of the worst traffic in the fucking world, like at all times of the day. So like just the weirdness of that, right? Because his power goes out, he has to contact somebody, they have to contact somebody at Riot, or he has to contact somebody at Riot directly. They have to make a determination of what to do. They're like, well, you know, can you play from somewhere else? And he's like, I guess I can go to the FlyQuest, you know, office.
Like, yeah. Or an hour away.
You know, this is LA, so it's somewhere else. You gotta like wait that time, and then he has to get there. If he's one of those weird players that only uses, you know, a certain keyboard and mouse, that means he has to pack all his shit up.
Yeah.
Go to that facility, set it up, set up all his macros. If his macros aren't set, like it's such a long.
It's an ordeal.
And yeah. So.
I guess they made it work, Yeah, had a pretty eventful final that TSM eventually ended up winning. But both these teams are gonna go to Worlds, and hopefully they won't have any similar problems during that tournament. But yeah, I think I don't know if 2020 is just unique in the fact that we get these weird confluence of events that leads to situations like this. I don't think we'll ever see any weird things like this ever again. We'll never have to. I mean, at some point we'll have to stop a final one day for one person, but it'll be for something else other than one person got a power outage and nobody else did. It'll be a whole different set of issues, but it's just an incredibly unique circumstance that only happens in LA, only happens in California.
Rolling blackouts, like, which is a thing I know about because I've looked into it, right? Like, and I've read about it, about, you know, like the weird power grid California has and all this stuff, and like the overloads and the worry about fire and just power facilities blowing up. So like the scheduled rolling blackouts to keep the facilities cool and well maintained and all this other kind of stuff, and like all this weird shit that like is foreign not only to the like rest of the world, but the rest of the, well, no, not the rest of the world, because there are other countries and places that that do these kind of things too, in similar fashions.
Yeah, but I mean, it's something that will, we haven't had that situation, I think, for like a decade. So I think it's just kind of unique to the circumstances that we're in now. And I think, I think this may be the first and only time that this, something like this happens, even though it seems like something that would happen more often. But I think, a final getting delayed because one person and only one person has to drive for an hour through LA traffic to, because of a blackout is going to be unique. G2 Esports won the European Championship. Top Esports won the Chinese Championship, and Damwon Gaming won the Korean Championship. So those four teams and a couple other teams from their regions, as well as other teams from around the world, will meet in the World Championship later this year. So congratulations to all of them. No congratulations to Cloud9 for throwing it. On to football. Got a couple big contracts for DeAndre Hopkins and Alvin Kamara. You can look those up if you want. But yeah, I feel like we've been talking a lot about contracts lately, and all these contracts are just big. It's a lot of money. And so that's the Kamara one is kind of interesting because the Saints seem like they're very congested when it comes to their salary cap. So I'm not sure how they managed to free up all this money to pay Alvin Kamara. But for a second, he was demanding a trade. So they managed to work through that. And now he's going to be with the team long term and get paid. So good for him. Yeah. As a running back, who we always say to get your money if you're a running back, because who knows when the injuries are going to start hitting. Games are going on right as we speak. Having fun with fantasy football. You got the first overall pick and spent it on Patrick Mahomes. So,
and I feel good about that.
Stay true to the brand.
Look, I mean, you, especially in a snake draft, right? When you have the first pick, you're up, and then you are off the clock for a long time. So you got to go for the most value you can possibly get, right? So for me, it was between Lamar Jackson and Patrick Mahomes at that position. So I don't know how well taking like a big name running back or any of those other kind of things would do right now, whereas you just kind of go for a well-established player that you know can get a lot of points.
Yeah, the idea I think behind the running backs always being at the top is because there's not many good running backs. So like the drop off between the top ones and the ones below is pretty steep. But for quarterbacks, you can, you know, the drop off between maybe between Patrick Mahomes and the next tier is it's a little steep, but maybe it's not steep enough to spend the first overall pick on. Maybe people will disagree, but I think there's merit to the idea of getting somebody that you know is not going to give you problems all year. I think I've done the thing where I try to just load up on running backs, and then all year I'm just rotating quarterbacks between guys like, you know, Alex Smith and Andy Dalton, trying to figure out who's going to get me 10 points that week when, you know, you're going to get 20 out of Patrick Mahomes every week. So that's, you know, I don't fault you for making that decision, but, I think, it'll be a wait and see thing, and we'll have to wait and see how that decision affects the rest of your team. But yeah, it's fun to get into fantasy football again. I think I had to say in the rules that if somebody on your team doesn't play because of COVID, then too bad. These are just things that you have to address now. It'll be a fun season, I think. And it was a fun pretty fun kickoff game, or at least a very productive kickoff game, even though it wasn't a very dramatic one on Thursday between two of the guys that we've talked about a lot recently, Patrick Mahomes and Deshaun Watson, both of whom got very rich. So DJM says pray for Deshaun Watson. Glad he got paid, because his offensive line isn't doing a great job of protecting him. Some of his weapons are gone. DeAndre Hopkins, who we just talked about, got a big contract from Arizona. And he was one of those weapons that was traded away. Although David Johnson, the guy he got traded for, did okay. Got himself a touchdown. So I think for now that trade is working out for both sides. But we'll have to see long term. Thinking way long term, I know it seems like a long time from now, but June 23rd, 2021 is going to be the start date of the Summer Olympics that were postponed this year. The Summer Olympics in Tokyo, they basically said they're doing that no matter what. They actually even included the phrase with or without COVID in their plans. So so when I talk about people kind of powering through, this is if anybody is listening to this show in 5 years from now and just looking back, this is the state of the world at this point, where everybody's just kind of over the pandemic, even though the pandemic isn't over.
It's just that's not a thing you can. That's because, like, a lot of the statements in this, right, though, with or without COVID, the games that conquered COVID, like, those are sound bites and clips and statements that can then come back and bite you in the ass. Like, because then people will look at you and blame you because you're the one who said it, right? Yeah. Like, even if everyone in the room agreed on it, even if everyone in the room had the same sentiment, when it comes time to save face, if something bad happens, they'll be like, he was the one that said, you know, with or without, and look what happened. You know, like, I think, yep. I think you keep some kind of even keel and you say, hey, you know, we have so many precautions in place, to make sure that we can go through with this. We're looking forward to going through with this, but we are definitely keeping our eyes on the numbers, yada, yada, yada. It's an easy press release to say. Saying shit like this is big, big oof, I think.
Yeah. The thing is, I think they can always fall back on just no fans. And the Olympics themselves, there are kind of, I don't want to say they're easy to bubble, but they are, considering like everybody who goes to the Olympics stays in the same spot. So I think you can at least organize a bubble environment. They always construct like the Olympic Village, and that's where the athletes stay every time. Like, you can organize a bubble environment around the Olympics. I think the athletes will be most at risk whenever they're actually at their stadiums and other venues for actually doing their events. And then also, like, the volunteers that are, or not the volunteer, but like the employees and the other people working the events. And so who knows whether they're bubbled or not, but. I think these are pretty bold statements. I think if they ban the U.S. from the Olympics, I feel like this is something that they could, I'd feel more strongly about the potential for success. Not that that's something I want, but I think, it's, you know, this is a worldwide event, and that's kind of the risk. If part of the world isn't taking the pandemic seriously, then you have to kind of side eye them and treat them like they are the biggest risks. But I guess if everybody tests clean when coming in, then It's not like they don't have a big old testing program set up already for performance enhancing drugs. So they can incorporate COVID testing into that as well. They just have to be a lot more vigilant about testing often.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a long wait and see. Another year long wait and see is some racing news. We've got Jimmy Johnson, NASCAR aficionado, heading to IndyCar after he retires from his NASCAR career this year.
So Indy is kind of making this bigger push to do more in kind of have a bigger presence lately, and they've been trying to pull in more of these well-known drivers, and to me, because of my affinity with NASCAR, being Jimmy Johnson, this is like kind of a big thing for me. Like, I got into NASCAR during that span of Jimmy Johnson winning seven championships. So watching Jimmy Johnson, who has more or less been struggling in NASCAR in these latter years, go into this you know, open wheel, you know, single seat IndyCar stuff is pretty interesting, right? Because it seems so drastically different, but I mean, it kind of is. I just don't really know how to pace it, because I'm not that like much at some point, a racing guy.
At some point, racing is racing, but at another point, it is different, right? To go from stock cars to open wheel and on top of that, just adjust to a whole new team. He's going to be on Chip Ganassi Racing, even just the fact that you know, more road courses and fewer oval courses. I think these guys are pretty good drivers, so it's not going to affect them that much. But I mean, at the same time, when you're at the at kind of a top level, competitive wise, you're competing against other guys, and every little difference matters. So it'll be interesting to see where one of the best NASCAR drivers of all time, even though he's not kind of at the top anymore, but it'll be interesting to see where he stacks up. And as somebody who follows, you know, the worldwide one, Formula One, I've kind of needed a push to look at open wheel racing within the United States, and the IndyCar has been a fixture of that for a long time. So all I really hear about is the Indianapolis 500, and that's kind of it. And then so hopefully this can help with marketing IndyCar racing to a wider audience, because even if it doesn't, I want to see an American driver in Formula One one day. And I want to see like the IndyCar program. I want to see it, you know, start churning out amazing drivers, and not necessarily just be a place where people who don't make it in F1 end up congregating.
And I mean, that's kind of how some people are going to look at this. They're just going to be like, oh, you know, he's past his prime, can't handle it in NASCAR, so he's going to this thing. Whereas guys,
question for you, since JVZ just brought up a great point and I'm curious about it, what do you think is the disconnect between Americans and Formula One? What do you think the disconnect there is? Is it just that it's NASCAR, or is it something else?
That's part of it, and I think I saw a YouTube video from I think the name is Cranky Yankee F1, the kind of covering this, like, why is there not, like, you know, or can an American driver ever make it in F1? And I think part of it is the history. Like, NASCAR is very ingrained, not just it's very ingrained to the history of the United States in general, because it started with I forgot what amendment to the Constitution it was, but whichever one prohibited alcohol.
The Prohibition era.
Yeah, to the Prohibition era. And it started from there. And like a lot of the cars that were designed to evade the cops when trying to run bootleg alcohol, you know, eventually became the cars that were used in racing circuits, and that's what eventually led to NASCAR. So it's that's why it's so ingrained in that particular region of the United States, and that's why it's so ingrained within the history of the United States itself. Mm-hmm. So the driver programs that are designed to encourage young people to get into racing, they're geared towards NASCAR, or they're geared towards IndyCar, which also has a foothold in the United States. So young drivers are not racing, and young American drivers are not racing under the same circuits that other young drivers around the world that are hoping to get into F1 are racing on. Mm-hmm. So they're not part of the same development programs. They're not racing against the same competition. So I think that's part of why an American driver hasn't quite had a long-term foothold in F1 yet. And I think that's why there's kind of a disconnect. There's also the fact that there's only one American race every year in the F1 calendar, and they're trying to increase that.
But the big problem with that is the way that the way that F1 works, right? They do these open circuits in these cities where they take over roadways, right? That's really hard to do in America. The few times we've done that, the local people have fought against that, right? The cities have been for that, the racing fans have been for that, but the people who live in those areas have been against those things, right? They don't understand what it is or what it means. They just understand that their city is shut down. Like, a big portion of their city is shut down. Like, here in Baltimore, there aren't many other ways to get around something to go downtown. So when they had a race here, it literally just shut down downtown. You couldn't get in or out of the downtown area. So it's one of these things where it has to be able to happen in places where it doesn't effectively cripple a city, right? It has to be able to be something that adds to the city, like other events do when they come to a town. So that's a hard thing to get the kind of people who live in those areas to fall into. Our roads are shit. Our roads are garbage.
Well, to elaborate on that point, I think the U.S. has enough circuits around the country. Like, even though most of them are designed for oval track NASCAR stuff, they all have a road course as mm-hmm. well for other events. And so I think there's plenty of that. The Circuit of the Americas in Austin, Texas, that's the one that has a deal with F1 to have a race there every year. That's where the United States Grand Prix is currently held every year. They've had issues in the past with the Indianapolis Raceway, including the 2005 United States Grand Prix, where because of an issue with the banked curves in Indianapolis, a bunch of tires started failing, and basically everybody that was under one tire manufacturer just decided they could not race that weekend. So they only had six cars racing in 2005. I think that was a big, that pissed a lot of people off. So while F1 was trying to gain a foothold in the United States. So I think the Circuit of the Americas is fine. I think they tried to set up a road course like you were talking about in Miami. And I think that was they were going to take over the roads near the stadium where the Dolphins play. And I'm not sure where that has. That's got some local resistance as well. There's been talk about doing a street course in New York, which might be a mess. And there's been also talk about going back to Indianapolis now that Penske owns the Indianapolis Raceway. So there's a lot of potential there. So I think Liberty Mutual, which is an American company, owns F1 now. So I think they're going to go hard on trying to market F1 in the United States. Yeah. because they see that there's a lot of potential there. Usually it's not the American market that is for sports. It's not the American market that people are trying to tap into. It's other markets around the world. But in this case, there's a lot of money to be made potentially by getting more people into F1. All right. On to boxing. Speaking of a lot of money at stake, Canelo Alvarez is suing DAZN and Golden Boy Promotions. I think we talked about it when this deal was initially struck. There was an 11-fight deal for $365 million, which was very lucrative. At the time, he's fought three of those fights, and there's about $280 million left on that contract to earn. But there's a lot of conflicts internally between Canelo Alvarez's camp and DAZN and Golden Boy. Like, they're all kind of feuding with each other in this hate triangle at this point. I think DAZN is accusing Golden Boy of misrepresenting the idea that one of these fights would be against Gennady Golovkin. And Alvarez is saying, like, no, they should not have promised that on his behalf. There's disputes over the opponents that Canelo Alvarez has been presented for his 2020 fights, which I don't think he's fought at all this year. So he's supposed to be making $35 million every time he fights. Because they're not offering him, or he says they're not offering him acceptable fights, and he also says he's willing to take some sort of cut in revenue to make up for COVID, but they just haven't given him an adequate plan yet. So because of that, he's missing out on, you know, if he were to fight two times a year, he's missing out on $70 million this year. Mm-hmm. He's trying to sue for breach of contract. So either they let him out of his contract and he goes and signs for some other broadcaster and some other promotion, or they try to work something out. But as of right now, this very lucrative deal that was also supposed to position DAZN as like a figurehead in combat sports broadcasting. This deal that was supposed to be the linchpin of that is looking like it's going to fall apart at this point. The lawsuit itself, to get in the nitty gritty details, has technically been dismissed, but that's kind of just it'll be resubmitted. There's just like some very minor details that need to be worked out so that they can file this in United States federal court. But once they work that out, they'll probably re-sue again, because it doesn't look like this relationship has been repaired. But this is what sucks about boxing. You got all these different kind of independent fighters joining different promotions, and every time fighters across promotions want to fight each other, then it becomes a big old negotiation. Yeah. There's a couple like governing bodies that issue belts, but even then there's like no unified one. You kind of just have to capture all the belts if you want to be declared an undisputed champion. It's really
confusing. Like, it's hella confusing.
Yeah. Even like the Mayweather Pacquiao fight from so many years ago, these guys were on opposite promotions. And so because of that, it took years of negotiating over drug testing and other minor details. And by the time they got done negotiating, both those fighters were that fight came like old. 3 years too late.
Yeah.
So it's one thing that definitely hurts boxing when you compare it to other combat sports like MMA, where the UFC kind of just dominates everything. Sometimes that's a bad thing because the UFC controls so much of the money there. But every time they want to make a fight in the UFC, Dana White just declares this person is fighting this person on this date, like 5 months from now. and that's it. And that's all it takes. And boxing could kind of use something like that.
Yeah. Like boxing needs some kind of overseer, some kind of overhead figure that can just make deals. And then I think somewhere in the background that it should be like, this fight is going to happen, right? That's whatever. You can argue over the whatevers. If somebody is a champion, I think it should be like a 60-40 split, or like if it's two challengers pushing up, you know, whatever, depending on record, it should be a 50-50 split. Like, but it becomes down to these micro little things where people are trying to get these little edges in one way or the other. So it just it ends up hurting the sport.
Yeah, you got to negotiate catch weights and all that. DJM brings up a good point that this is kind of what the WBO and the WBC and all those governing bodies were originally supposed to be. I think anybody who's a programmer will recognize why this doesn't work. It's like every time you have like five standards and then one person wants to come up with a standard to unify all five of those standards. But then nobody buys into that unification, and now you got six standards, and then you know, lather, rinse, and repeat, and now you got seven standards. So it's you know, I can't believe I'm saying this, but it kind of takes like a Vince McMahon figure to kind of come in and buy up all this shit to actually unify it all, and until they're actually structurally unified, it's always going to be this piecemeal thing where everybody who wants to fight anybody has to go through a long set of negotiations. And because of that, then they got to pay their promoters and then it's not the athletes getting paid. It's all these other administrative people when all you really need for boxing is one person with a phone camera and two people that are mad at each other enough to fight each other. And like World Star Hip Hop pulls this shit off just as well as some of these promoters do. Maybe not with as much flair, but like, you know, they effectively accomplish the same things. And
like DJM says, right, it's also not because these people want to give their fighter the best options and the best money. It's because they have their own agendas, right? They want to show that they can pull in the best money so that they can get more fighters under their promotion so that they can make more money, right? It's not doing what's best for the fight. It's doing what's best for yourself. So it ends up hurting the sport altogether because of these things.
Yeah.
All right. Enough of shitting on fighting sports. Let's talk about basketball and some of our sadness. The Lakers are still in it for some reason.
Yeah. That's always disappointing for me, but I don't know. This is one of the more likable Lakers teams in a long time. It's really just the fans that piss me off.
Look, you know what? I know
you don't like LeBron that much, but
yeah.
Overall, I feel like on the likability scale, he's on the positive end.
As a human being, LeBron's a great guy. Does a lot for the communities that he plays in. Does a lot for the game of basketball overall. But as a player, fuck that guy.
Him and Anthony Davis. I mean, I don't really like how that team got assembled together. I don't like, you know, what it means for basketball to have, you know, a team that was just bad for a long time.
When your star player is also your general manager and your head coach.
Yeah. Just assemble a team just because everybody's attracted to the LA market. Yeah. That bothers me. But overall, like between LeBron and Anthony Davis, the other cast of characters they have on the team, like J.R. Smith and Alex Caruso is a guy that I don't think we brought up on the show yet, but I think he's been a fun player to watch all season. So you know, Rajon Rondo, who is always a weird character, especially when he gets to the playoffs. It's an interesting bundle of characters carried by LeBron and Anthony Davis. And so they managed to survive. Oh, and JaVale McGee. I can't forget JaVale McGee.
Yeah.
Two-time NBA champion JaVale McGee, I should say. They managed to survive against the Houston Rockets, who we'll get into soon. But a pretty disappointing effort from Houston. Another disappointing effort from the Milwaukee Bucks, who we kind of alluded to how badly they were performing before. They managed to get one game after Giannis got injured last Sunday. But after that, I mean, it was just a poor overall showing from the Milwaukee Bucks against the Miami Heat. So it'll be Boston Celtics versus Miami Heat in the Eastern Conference Finals. Go ahead.
Before we get like kind of too far away from that, I want to talk about a lot of the stuff that has been coming up kind of in the sports sphere of does this mean small ball is bad? You know what I mean? Like because the Rockets have lived on this idea of small ball, more perimeter shots, using the ideal of James Harden and Russell Westbrook to drive the lane, get rebounds, put back shots, all this kind of stuff, right? Whereas the Lakers kind of have a standard, they can spread the ball out a little bit better. They have their low post guys to fight for rebounds, things like that. You have your perimeter shooters, all this stuff. And I don't necessarily think that small ball is bad. I think the Rockets had a really good idea. I just don't think they had enough players to really do what that ideal, what in my brain watching it, that ideal really should be, which is to have people who aren't scared to take mid-range jumpers, but also have the ability to have the foresight to pass the ball to someone else who can also shoot and drive. Because I think you just have two people on that team that, you know, without anyone else, just the majority of your scoring. And when you can figure out how to shut those two people down, that's pretty much it. You figure out how to shut down James Harden and Russell Westbrook. That's pretty much it. Right, because no one else, I think, on that team has gotten enough touches, except for maybe Austin Rivers, to really, really know what to do with the ball.
The Rockets are definitely an analytics team, and I'm kind of glad you brought this up, because there's kind of the question of like, how are we seeing so many of these successful regular season teams just fail so hard in the playoffs? And well, we've talked about it a little bit in the past, but there needs to be a lot more investigation and analysis, and the data nerds need to get on this too, because a lot of the analytics discussion is used to assemble a team for an 82 game regular season, but then when you get to the playoffs, it's kind of a completely different animal, because on top of it, you end up, you know, you drop the bottom half of the league, all the bad teams that are down there. You're not playing those guys anymore. On top of that, you're playing the same team potentially seven games in a row, at least four games. So every time, you know, and on top of that, like that team is, you know, they're not traveling from city to city to try to get to you, especially now that everybody's playing in the same place. But even before, like, you're playing the same team every time, you're game plan, you're focused on, you know, if you let somebody score on you a bunch one game, then you're going to be intensely focused on making sure that doesn't happen the next game. That you can totally game plan for people. You take away people's first and second best skills. And so, like, you've got a team like the Rockets that is designed to drive the lane and shoot threes. That's what analytics says you're supposed to do, because those are the really efficient shots. But then in the playoffs, those really efficient shots are not as efficient as they used to be, because teams are game planned to try to stop it. So now you got to look at second and third options, like who can take those mid-range shots that everybody is discouraged from taking during the regular season. Who, like you said, who is not afraid to take those shots and who is not afraid to miss those shots, but take them because they're open, because they're mm-hmm. available. And I think part of why the Warriors were so good the last couple of years is not just like they can do the 3-point shooting and they do it a lot better than most other teams. But, you know, they had guys like Kevin Durant that weren't afraid to take those shots and weren't afraid to initiate their own shots. And, you know, and you know, when offenses completely break down in the playoffs, you know, who, you know, sometimes as much as I hate isolation basketball, sometimes it helps, you know, when you're missing a bunch of shots in a row to just have a guy you can just give the ball to, you know, just give the ball to Kevin Durant and see what he can make happen. We just need 2 points right now, so that, you know, we can kind of reset. We haven't scored in the last 5 minutes. We just need somebody to score so that we can remember that what we're capable of. And so, like, there's a mental game to it. There's a physical game to it. Everybody's tired. There's a strategic game to it as well, with your first and second strategies not being available. It's a completely different environment in the playoffs than in the regular season, yet all the analytics are focused on regular season success. So I think that's Houston peaked at game 7 in the Western Conference Finals a couple years ago when they missed 27 straight 3-pointers. It kind of lends the question, why did they shoot 27 straight? Well, why did they keep shooting that many 3-pointers when it wasn't working? Like, and it's kind of, they didn't have other options because that's what everything was structured around. So it's mm-hmm. like, yeah, so it's just interesting to see how playoff basketball is different than regular season basketball and the drama behind it. You know, it's why we play the game. And I think that's kind of why, you know, teams assembled like LeBron's Lakers are still doing so well, even though they drop a few games here and there. The Toronto Raptors, I think, are also a pretty well assembled team. I think they had a better effort from Pascal Siakam. Maybe the 7-game series with the Celtics would have worked out in their favor, but
yeah,
in the end, like, it was still a very close series between the two, and one that looked like it was going to be a blowout in favor of the Celtics early on if OG Anunoby hadn't hit that 3-pointer to win Game 3. But yeah, they were there to go from down 2-0 in the series and eventually end up forcing Game 7. I think is a great effort from that team, especially coming off the heels of losing a guy like Kawhi Leonard. I think that team has a bright future. They're well coached. Unfortunately, like, they've got a couple guys that are free agents now. I think Fred VanVleet's a free agent. I think Serge Ibaka might be a free agent as well. So I don't know if those guys are going to want to stick around or they'll want to go get paid somewhere else.
But it's a team of people like Serge Ibaka, Kyle Lowry, right, who have in their time been sixth mans on other teams, right? Like Marc Gasol is probably the only guy here, but he's latter in his years that is probably a notable starting five guy. Right. Yeah. And I could almost see them staying, because if they go anywhere else, they go, like, yeah, you're probably going to get paid, but you go back to being a sixth man somewhere. Right. Like that's how most teams are going to, like,
yeah. Like most, you said,
analytically,
like a third piece.
Right. You're not going to be the first name on most people's list. So I think this is one of those times where it's just kind of weirdly a weird sense of serendipity where you were the guys who were brought in to bolster this one guy. But because of the basketball IQ here, right, Marc Gasol is a really good smart player. I think Serge Ibaka is a really smart player. I don't know. I feel like if you leave, you're kind of doing yourself a disservice, where you have this team that could really do something with a couple more pieces. Like, but
yeah, I mean, run it back. I mean, also their G League team is I think, especially notable for how well they've developed players in the past. So even though they're kind of drafting late in the draft, they got Pascal Siakam from their G League team, or they developed him in their G League team. He's still on a rookie contract right now. So he's, definitely exceeding his, how much they're paying him. So I think, they can get a lot of value from other players that they end up promoting from their G League team. Then, if they run it back, I think this is a well-run team. It's a well-led team. You mentioned Kyle Lowry, and I feel like he's gotten a lot of, I've seen a lot of articles recently talking about how important he is to this team and how well he does a lot of the little things. So I'm glad to see him get a lot of respect when I think, the narrative around him maybe 5 years ago was that he would choke in the playoffs. But how quickly things change when you win an NBA championship and then everybody starts talking about you a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. So it was a good effort from the Raptors. Not so much from the Bucks and the Rockets. For the Rockets, I think the talk now is like, do you blow this up? For one thing, like the story just broke that Coach Mike D'Antoni is not returning. His contract has expired and he doesn't really want to come back. Technically the contract expired, but in a way he quit. even Daryl Morey, the general manager, like his future is kind of up in the air because of everything that happened with the China stuff. And also like he's been with the team for a while. And, I think it's pretty clear that the team itself has peaked. They owe Russell Westbrook a lot of money over the next two or three seasons, in the $40+ million range, because he was on a Supermax contract that he signed with, Oklahoma City. And then on top of that, they're very light on draft picks because they gave up a lot of them to Oklahoma City in order to get Russell Westbrook. James Harden is always going to be worth his contract because mm-hmm. he's incredibly productive and incredibly efficient, even though he's incredibly boring to watch sometimes. the rest, it's like you said, it's like you got those two guys and then who else? They traded for Robert Covington in their effort to do the small ball experiment. There's not a whole lot of room for them to maneuver financially. They're kind of stuck that way while Russell Westbrook is on the roster. So between all that and the coach leaving, maybe some uncertainty with the general manager, they're under new ownership as well. Tillman Fertitta bought the team recently, and fans have not been happy with all the little things that he's been cheaping out on since he bought the team, even though he's a rich billionaire. This is a team with a very uncertain future, and I feel like Oklahoma City just robbed them blind. Obviously, we'll have to wait and see like who they get from those draft picks. But if Houston blows it up now, then Oklahoma City is going to get a lot of good return on the draft picks that they got for Russell Westbrook. And on top of that, they'll be able to trade Chris Paul and get even more draft picks. On top of that, they have all those draft picks that they got for Paul George. So I think that's a team that's well positioned for the future. The Rockets are not.
Yeah. I agree. Like I don't see like as you were saying this, right? I'm painting this picture of my head. I'm looking around the league. I'm thinking about who you could trade for. I didn't look at the free agency list or anything like that, but I'm trying to think what you do there, right? Because the only option I really have is to move Russell Westbrook. But then at the same time, who's going to take that, right? Like, yeah. Like what GM in their right mind goes, yeah, you know what I want right now? A Supermax player. like I don't see a lot of people looking at that and welcoming that with open arms, right? So you lose out there because either if somebody takes it, they're going to try to stick you with the bill at least for a year or two. Even if they take on the money hit, they're not going to give you much. They're going to want more in return. So they're going to want whatever couple of draft picks you got, whatever good role players you got as well. And they'll give you maybe one or two good prospects and a draft pick, if that, like, because they feel like they're going to be taking the bigger hit. Right. So like it's a hard thing to look at.
Yeah. And that's all that plus this Danwell House situation.
Yeah.
I guess I won't spend too much time on this, but part of what kind of threw the Rockets for a loop this series, I think they were doing okay after the first couple games, but then Danwell House missed the third game. He's kind of in a sixth man tier player on this Rockets team. But yeah, he missed the third game and then by the fourth game, people figured out why, and that was because he was kind of quarantined by the league for having an unauthorized guest in his room, which was a COVID tester. From the details, you can kind of assume that he was having an affair with this person. So on top of that, I think this person who got caught tried to implicate Tyson Chandler, which, you know, another teammate, and then who was eventually cleared of any misconduct. But yeah, just to have, you know, a guy who you kind of expect, it's like having an injury on the team, an unexpected injury, you know, to lose a guy that is that important to your team. Just suddenly, but also with all the extra baggage that comes along with it, because this is an entirely a self-inflicted decision on his part to try to sneak this person into his room. And on top of that, I think now all these issues with the future of the team and throw chemistry issues on top of it. And the coach that was in charge of keeping all these people together is now deciding he doesn't want to come back. So not a very good future for this Rockets team. They might prove us wrong. I think James Harden just continuously proves me wrong by, you know, output increasing his production over and over again. But there's only so much that one man can do. So we'll have to wait and see, but I think they gave it a good effort. They were out of all the teams that in the West that decided that the Warriors were gonna just run away with everything the next 4 years, and the Rockets were the one team that actually tried to get into an arms race with them and tried to punch back. So in a way, I'm kind of sad that this experiment looks like it's about to end, but they gave it a good effort. On the WNBA side, their season, they had a bit of a shorter season this year, 22 games. So that's about wrapping up. This Tuesday, the 15th, is when the first playoff games are scheduled to start. I think seven of the eight teams in the playoffs have been decided already, kind of led by Seattle and Las Vegas up at the top. The Washington Mystics, who we thought were at the beginning of the season, were doing really, really well. I think they're kind of on the borderline. They're currently the eighth seed, and I think they can clinch pretty soon, which would be pretty good for them considering all the stars that they're missing. But yeah, the WNBA playoffs are going to shape up to be a pretty pretty exciting. So once the NBA season wraps up, we still got more playoff basketball to watch after that. All right. Baseball. We got a couple odd stories. We're still kind of in the middle of the season, so and we're at the part where we're just kind of trying to find anything exciting about baseball. One thing that came across my plate earlier this week was that the Tampa Bay Rays made a little bit of history with the first all left-handed start or batting lineup for their starting lineup. I think there's been all lefties before, but usually there's been a couple switch hitters in there, but this was the first time that a manager looked at his team and decided just take 9 left-handed batters and put them all out there. So I think interesting milestone in the history of baseball.
I mean, interesting milestone, interesting play overall, right? Because they're all essentially going to get the same look at the ball, right? Yeah. Like everybody being in the same box gets the same look at the ball, and you kind of almost get the opposing defense to play the ball the same way every single time. So if you have those guys who have good bat and ball control to be able to hit the ball in the other direction, that's really good, right? Because you're always going to kind of shift one way or the other based on the batter. And if you're kind of looking at this guy as a left-handed guy coming up to the plate, you're going to shift to the opposite side. So it's an interesting strategy, definitely. And I mean, it worked out for them. So
yeah, they won this game 11-1. A division game between them and the Boston Red Sox. The Rays are currently at the top of the American League standings. So I know DJM asked me before the show whether the Rays were my favorite team because they tend to experiment and do all these wild things. They're the ones that started with the opening pitcher experiment that now has other teams have tried to varying degrees of success. The Rays have always been a creative team, at least. So while they're not necessarily my favorite team in the league, I think they end up in a lot of our stories because they tend to do the odds and the ends that we like talking about here. One fun fact, even their starting pitcher was a lefty. So they went all in on this. It seems like it shouldn't work because it's almost like if you start a right-handed pitcher and against this all lefty lineup and it's not working, then it seems like you can just switch to a left-handed reliever, but maybe that just throws things off strategy wise and maybe you didn't plan for it. And it seems like something you could, a team could easily adjust to. But in this case, I guess all these guys were hitting so well that even any strategic adjustments to this weren't enough to stop this team from scoring 11 runs. So one interesting milestone. I guess I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet in the over 100 year, 10,000, hundreds of thousands of games of baseball that have been played.
It could have, we have to admit, baseball hasn't always been the best at like keeping track of things in their history, and there's a lot of shit that just, you know, goes mysterious.
Yeah, I guess we kind of have to like limit it to different eras, but it's just an interesting milestone.
Mm-hmm. So I kind of just quickly went over the stat line, right? Like hits wise. It's not that crazy, but I mean, you're batting in every run is an RBI. 12 hits overall.
12 hits, 11 runs. Yeah.
Yeah. 12 hits, 11 runs, but 11, I mean, but also 11 RBIs, right? So like that's where that line gets interesting. and just a lot of I don't know. They played this really well. I don't think this was an amazing thing. You know, having a 11 hitters, I do think this in a weird way, like, cuz some of these guys did not hit at all, but yeah, the Red Sox are also kind of bad this season, as DJM points out in the notes.
They are, I guess, tied for last in the American League. So I guess when you got the best team in the league going up against one of the worst, especially if they're the worst in your division, then I guess you can basically try fancy stuff like this. I think I remember seeing like all the games the Red Sox won this year were against the Yankees. Is that? I don't know if I'm correct on, like, they basically lost to everybody else.
That would track, but I don't have to go check.
They haven't won every game against the Yankees, but it's just like all the ones that they have won.
Against the Yankees. Yeah. I could see it.
No, that's not true. I'm looking at the schedule right now, and I'm not sure where I saw that stat, but sorry for peddling misinformation. They haven't been good at all. They're not like making the playoffs. They won 16 games out of, they're winning 34% of their games, so not great. All right, moving on to the Los Angeles Dodgers, specifically Joe Kelly, who became a bit of a folk hero for his antics against the Houston Astros the last time they played. He very famously made a little mean mugging face against just before both benches cleared and they almost fought with each other. So somebody took a picture of that and turned it into a mural on the wall of Floyd's Barbershop in Los Angeles. The artist Jonas Never, I think he's painted a lot of cool murals in the past. We've got a link in the show notes. The Astros hate is still alive. If that's the story you want to take out of this, especially in Los Angeles, people are traveling to this place to come take pictures of this mural. Even Joe Kelly brought his family out there to come take a picture in front of this mural with the artist. So that's pretty cool. I love it when people do art of athletes and then the athletes buy into it and at least acknowledge it. But even to go out there and participate this much in somebody else's tribute work is super cool to see. The hate is real. The hate is alive. We talked about how hard it is to get anywhere in Los Angeles, and people are braving that to go line up and take pictures in front of this mural. So that's
this. You see, this is the shit that makes sports fun, right? Like these little instances of, you know, just rivalry or just something, right? And this one I love because, you know what? Fuck the Astros, they cheated. Like,
it's about being petty. It's sports gives you a chance to be petty about something that actually really in the grand scheme of things is not that important.
Yeah,
but you pretend it's important, and you know, so it's cosplay, it's theater, it's an excuse to get emotional about something that that is just, you know, people in one shirt versus people in another shirt. But people in those other shirts cheated, so fuck them.
All right, let's move on to our last story. What do you got for us?
Yeah, I think this is a story that is close to the hearts of some of our listeners. I think one of the best traditions in college football, or maybe just in sports in general, was kind of started by the University of Iowa, and they had a tradition back when they had fans in their stadium of, for all their home games, I think during one of the breaks in the game, everybody in the stadium, period. And this was something that like opposing teams and their staff would look forward to as well. But everybody would turn and wave at the children's hospital that was near the stadium. And usually during that moment, the kids would gather in some of the upper levels of the stadium and watch from the windows and wave back. So I think the Kinnick wave is what this tradition is called.
Yeah.
And so now during COVID, that's, you know, not really something that can happen because the University of Iowa had a couple of their games canceled, or actually most of their season canceled, I believe. So during the first scheduled game, a couple people decided that, like, okay, these kids are going to be missing out on this tradition, so let's all gather. It was kind of an impromptu thing. Like, they didn't really schedule it just because gatherings are, large public gatherings are not allowed. I think otherwise more people would have shown up, but it's, you know, like 9 cheerleaders, the school mascot, and maybe a dozen fans or so, all gathered and near just outside the stadium. And, during the time where this normally would have happened, but the game had been canceled, they just all gathered outside the stadium and stood there and waved at the kids, and the kids waved back. And and I think they did this for 10 minutes, which is, I think, is much longer than they normally do it for. So it's cool to see, like, one of these sports traditions that is bigger than sports itself, continue even throughout COVID, even though we got so much uncertainty around everything else around sports, that, you know, they've found a way to keep this one little thing that is important to this group of people, just to keep this one positive thing going. So just another heartwarming story to take us out.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those other things about sports, right? Sports can be very heartwarming and very, like, camaraderie and bring people together. Like, we talk about being able to, it allows you a lot of energy for a lot of things. So it's just good.
Yeah. So the Kinnick wave is what this is called. So if you want to look up videos on YouTube about this tradition, we also have a link in the show notes to a story from The Athletic about it. You can see plenty of videos. It's a pretty amazing sight to watch all these people waving during the before times. And so one day we'll see this again, but, for now, this small group of people managed to keep this little tradition going. So thank you all for listening. Head on over to sportsoddsandends.com for links to our show notes, like we just mentioned. All the stories that we talked about, we'll have links there. We'll have videos. You can watch Novak Djokovic's Curb Your Enthusiasm moment. You can read up on all these other stories that we've talked about. Patreon.com/sportsoddsandends if you want to support the show financially. If you want to hit us up on Twitter, I'm at JVZ. Kaz is at King Kaz. DJM is at Call Me DJM. Hit us up throughout the week. Send us highlights and stuff because, we love interacting with you guys and interacting about sports. So thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time.